Reverend Dr. Gregory Neal is a graduate of Southern Methodist University as well as Duke University, where his studies included extensive work in Bible, theology, worship, and the sacraments. While having been trained to be a Christian educator, as an ordained United Methodist minister, Dr. Greg's heart and soul can be found in the mission and ministry of the local church as an agent for change in society. Prior to coming to Grace UMC as senior pastor, he served more than 30 years in the North Texas Conference, leading a multi-ethnic church, two reconciling congregations, two inner-city churches, and a vibrant university church. He is the author of several books, including Grace Upon Grace, Sacramental Theology and the Christian Life, as well as Seeking the Shepherd's Arms, Reflections from the Pastoral Side of Life. Now, I'm also going to introduce his husband, Cade, because they do some work together. Cade Rogers is a motivational speaker, a specialist in communications and administration, an accomplished singer-songwriter, and an activist for the full inclusion of LGBTQ plus persons in the United Methodist Church. Over the past few years, they've engaged in ministry together in the local church and the LGBTQ community, each complementing the gifts and graces of others. Let us hear from Greg Neal, and please say hello to his husband, Cade.
First question most people have is, husband? His husband? Yes, I'm gay. And that causes, sadly, that causes so many people problems. I say, well, when did you become gay? Oh, my God, I can't remember when I wasn't gay. It's not like something that I chose to do. It's who I am. It's how I was born. I grew up in a family in Texas that loved me and cared for me. Like many Texas families, it was very conservative, both religiously and politically. With a father who was involved in military and in engineering research and development, mother who was an insurance agent, an older brother who picked on his younger brother, Greg. Growing up in my family was a pleasure and a joy. I knew I was loved. I knew I was surrounded by love. That's why when my mother discovered that I was gay, by walking into my bedroom one day when I and my boyfriend were there, it was such a tragic experience for me. They did for me what parents who love their children do and try to do. They tried to care for me. They tried to take care of me. They tried to give me help. They took me to a reparative therapy program run by Exodus International. This was 1982. Back when that was considered how you helped and took care of people. They did not know. They did not comprehend. They could not comprehend the tragic damage that being forced as a teenager, as a 14-year-old, to go through such a program for several years, the damage that it would do, and how that damage would last with me, linger with me, for decades into my adult years and into my ministry. When I'm finished today, you'll be invited to ask questions, and I will entertain any question you have. But I invite you to listen as I tell a story about that boy who grew up after that discovery, thinking himself polluted, a mistake, and hellbound if I didn't change. And plagued by the reality that as much as I tried and as much as I prayed and as much as I begged Jesus over the years to change me, Jesus never seemed to be interested in changing my sexual orientation. No matter how much I prayed, no matter what I did, no matter how many quote unquote therapists I went to, that piece of me never changed. I went to college at Southern Methodist University, studied history, religion, and Russian language, answered a call into ministry, knowing that I couldn't do that because I'd been told that I couldn't be a pastor if I were gay. I'd become really good at pushing that part of my life down deep into the closet, deep into the shadows, and denying that element of who I am. Since I couldn't change myself, I begged Jesus to help me be celibate, because that's what I was told I had to be. I tested my vocation in a monastic community, thinking that might be my answer. It was not. I was called to be amongst the people of God, preaching and teaching the message of God's grace. So I went off to graduate school in Durham, North Carolina at Duke. I took student appointments. I was a licensed local pastor. I served for several years in North Carolina. I had a three-point charge. This means I preached in three different churches at the same time on the same Sunday. And then they added another church to the charge. So I was preaching 8, 9, 10, and 11 o'clock in the morning and driving between the churches. By the time I finished, I either loved my sermon or I hated it, usually hated it. Never did a sermon survive the entire morning without being changed. And then I moved back to North Texas, was ordained a deacon in the North Texas Conference in 1991. Took an appointment in North Texas, pastored there, was moved mid-year to a church in Dallas and served there for 4 years. Was ordained an elder in 1994, finished my doctoral work in 94. Entered into full-time pastoral ministry, serving churches throughout North Texas. The North Texas Conference, first of all, Texas is a very conservative place, if you didn't already know it. North Texas Conference is the most progressive conference of the Texas area. There are five conferences in Texas, or were. And North Texas was the most progressive, and still it was not a place where a gay man could be out, where a gay man could serve in ministry. So I had to be in the closet, and I was. Loathing myself, hating myself, having been taught to hate myself for years. Having been taught by the system that I served to hate myself for years. We had a don't ask, don't tell policy in the United Methodist Church in the 1990s and into the early 2000s. And so they never asked the question, are you gay? Not officially. But as a man in his 30s and then into his 40s, single, not married, having been introduced to granddaughter after granddaughter after granddaughter by members of my church, hoping to find me a spouse, and it never happening. I'm sure the administration of the conference knew. And in fact, more than one district superintendent told me quietly and on the side, just maintain your life in the closet. Don't let anyone know. Be celibate and you'll be okay. Then I served St. Stephen United Methodist Church in Mesquite, Texas. St. Stephen was the first reconciling congregation in the North Texas Conference. A reconciling church is a congregation that has dedicated themselves to being fully inclusive and affirming of its LGBTQ members and the community around it. St. Stephen was known for its progressive social action from the day of its founding in the 1960s until I was appointed there as senior pastor in 2007. The congregation there had several gay and lesbian members, couples and singles, fully involved in the life of the church and lay leadership positions all the way up to ad board, administrative board chair. And the wonderful LGBTQ people there embraced me and loved me. I came out to them and they affirmed me. And for the very first time, after having served in ministry for over 15 years, for the very first time I heard myself tell my church members that I was gay. And their love for me was unbounded, unlimited, and unafraid. They were afraid for me. They banded together to protect me, to ensure that things weren't said that shouldn't be said in places that it shouldn't be said. They loved me. They cared for me. And my ministry at St. Stephen was a blessing to me. And when I was appointed away from there, it hurt. I was appointed to another congregation. At that time, I was viewed as sort of a problem solver. I could go to a church and help them financially. I could help them in terms of their mission and ministry in their community. I'd been appointed to several churches that were in severe trouble, and I always left them in better shape than I found them. And that was true at St. Stephen in terms of their financial situation. And so they sent me to another congregation to help out. But it was like walking into a dark cave, into a cold, unwelcoming place. I began seeing a real therapist. And through several years of pastoral and loving therapy from an amazing therapist, I began to grow through study and therapy and fellowship with LGBTQ church members from several churches in the Dallas area, including with lay members of the Cathedral of Hope in Dallas, which at that time was part of the Metropolitan Community Church. I began to come out of that horrible self-loathing closet. I began to know myself as a child of God, formed and born and raised as a beautiful child of God, loved by God just as I am. I'm struck by the irony of, Billy Graham, in the Billy Graham Crusades, they used to sing, "Just as I am, without one plea." Just as I am, God loved me and made me who and what I am. And I was born this way, and I don't believe that God makes mistakes. I finally came to believe that, not just up here, for my intellectual study of the Bible and all the clobber passages that are there. I learned about them. I learned their history. I learned why they were there and what they really talked about. And so I had the intellectual knowledge, but it finally, through therapy, moved from my head to my heart. And I came to accept that there was nothing about me that God didn't love, and that I was and am the beautiful child of God as the gay man that I am. And then God did something that I prayed for but didn't think would ever possibly happen. God sent into my life an amazing man. A man very different from me, a man quite younger than me, a man who brought a different point of view, a different perspective, not just due to generational difference, but due to social background and upbringing. A man who pursued me. A man who broke through the shell that I had created to protect myself. A man who brought many talents and a vision and saw in me someone that he loved. And at first, when we entered into our relationship, we said, we're going to keep this a secret. This is going to have to be closeted between us because you're in pastoral ministry, Greg, and I'm in country music. And country music is the last frontier in the music genre for LGBTQ. And so we're just going to keep this quiet. This is going to be between us. No one needs to know. Then the pandemic hit. Things began to change. And we decided we couldn't continue with integrity that way. That we, for our own reasons, needed to be married. And so Kate asked me to marry him. And so I said, to do that, I'm going to have to officially come out to the bishop of the North Texas Conference and my district superintendents. I did that in January of 2020. And at first, there wasn't a problem. It was going to be okay. I was pastoring at that time a very conservative United Methodist Church in rural Texas. And so the bishop said, I'm going to have to get you to a reconciling congregation before you can come out to them. And then the pandemic hit, and suddenly there were no moves. You're going to have to stay there. And so Kate and I decided to go ahead. And with the cancellation and postponement of the General Conference of the United Methodist Church in 2020, that was supposed to make major changes to our Book of Discipline, with that event, Kate and I realized, we need to postpone our wedding until we can at least get to a church that is reconciling, that would accept us. So we postponed our wedding, then we postponed it again. We postponed it three times, waiting to get to where we needed to get to, where we could be safe and come out and be married. And that happened in 2021. We ended up at Lakewood United Methodist Church in Dallas, a reconciling congregation and affirming church that would receive us and accept us as a gay couple in ministry together, and a couple that would be planning to marry. And on October the 1st, 2022, Kate and I were married at Lakewood United Methodist Church. Married by a dear friend of ours who is a retired United Methodist minister who was also gay and married to his partner. It was the happiest day of my life. Thank you, Kate, for marrying me. And the very next day, a complaint was filed against me for marrying the man that I love. Now, to be very honest with you, we knew the complaint was coming. I helped write it. It was a friendly complaint. The friendly complaint process was simple. In the United Methodist Church, you can only have one complaint against you for any particular infraction at any given moment. And so to make sure that litigation wouldn't happen against me, that I wouldn't be taken to church court, a friend agreed to file the complaint if I would help write it. So it was filed the next day, intended to deflect unfriendly complaints, because this friend would be willing to negotiate a less than church trial and defrocking sentence process. It's a very arcane and very insane and very hypocritical process in the United Methodist Church still today, but it's a way to protect people. It's a tactic. And it works when you have a bishop who's willing to allow it to happen. That wasn't what happened with us. I went in for a meeting 2 weeks after our wedding, following our honeymoon, and the first thing that I was told was that I was being suspended from active ministry. While the bishop had needed what he called maneuvering room to figure out what to do, even though he knew the wedding was coming over a year ahead of time, he needed time to figure out what to do. There's a whole long story about that whole process. I'm not going to drag you through it. It's a nightmare. You feel soiled when you come out of it. The simple fact is, when it came down to it, they weren't going to be able to stop it. I was going to end up going to church trial. And I had a defense ready. But the chances of my losing my ordination and my appointment and my ministry were pretty good. And so, to stop the process, after a consultation with Cade, we agreed to transfer to another conference, to another region of the church, where my being married to the man that I love wouldn't be a problem for the administration. And once I made that announcement, the complaint process was halted. The suspension continued, but the complaint was placed into what they called abeyance, which means it was set aside while I found a conference to receive me, an appointment in another annual conference to serve in, and began the process to transfer my clergy credentials to a different region of the church, of the United Methodist Church. I made the announcement on January the 1st of this year that I was having to transfer out of North Texas and was looking for an appointment. And within 24 hours, I had multiple congregations and bishops and district superintendents reaching out to me to ask, would you be willing to come to Sacramento, to Seattle, to New York, to Denver, to Des Moines? And after interviews and consultations and conversations, many, I was appointed as the senior pastor here in Des Moines of Grace United Methodist Church, which was a great big wow at many levels. Iowa had been a conference where LGBTQ people were not safe. And then in 2021, the bishop at that time decided to establish with the cabinet a policy that complaints would not be received against clergy who were performing same-sex weddings, which is a violation of the Book of Discipline in the United Methodist Church. That was a huge step. And so when the question came up, could Greg serve in the Iowa Conference? He's an ordained elder of the North Texas Conference, going to be transferring. Could Greg serve under appointment at Grace in Des Moines, Iowa? The new bishop, Bishop Kenitha Bingham-Tsai, who started on January the 1st, was asked the question, and she said, absolutely, we're interested in effectiveness and one sexual orientation does not concern us. And so I came here in March. The day we got here for the interview with the Grace congregation, it snowed. Welcome to Iowa. We had a wonderful interview and the appointment was made. And on April the 15th, we moved to Iowa. And my first Sunday at Grace was April 23rd. And the congregation at Grace United Methodist Church here in Des Moines has been wonderful. Warm, accepting, affirming, protective, excited with both myself and Cade, especially Cade, as their pastoral family. We have been received by not just Grace Church, but by the whole community here in Des Moines. Have there been some nasty pieces of mail and email that have come from all over the place? Of course. But the largest percentage, the overwhelming majority of communications we have received have been affirming and welcoming, accepting, and transforming. And so we're here to stay. Kate and I are here to stay, to serve in ministry in this community, to pastor the wonderful people at Grace, and to be part of the LGBTQ community and the broader community here in Iowa. And we are so thrilled to be here, have the opportunity to serve in ministry here. Now, I know I just took you through a very, 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 very quick journey of a whole lot of stuff that happened over a very long period of time. Do you have any questions about what I have shared?
Dr. Neal, I think it should be safe to say that the biblical writers believe that the earth is flat,
mm-hmm.
that the sun went around the earth, and that heaven was up and hell was down, and we know better, and we've been willing to forgive the biblical writer for their mistakes of fact,
mm-hmm.
and recalibrate our understanding of the Bible accordingly.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say that the biblical writer also believed that they and everybody else, their readers, are straight?
Yes, the biblical world had no conception of sexual orientation other than straight. They believed that everybody was heterosexual, and therefore homosexual attraction or activity was contrary to God's will. And as we know through physiological and psychological studies of the human being, we know that's not the case. We know just as the earth is not flat, we know that just as the sun does not orbit around the earth, we know that human beings are born with a broad spectrum of sexual orientation, far broader than we even understand. And that ancient understanding does not necessarily have to govern us today. Absolutely. That's true about the biblical witness across the board, both in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament. The statements, I'll give you a good example. Paul says in the first letter to the Romans that people have homosexual attractions to others because they engage in idolatry, as a punishment for idolatry. Well, we know that people are gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender because they're born that way, not because they worship Zeus and Apollo. And so what Paul had to say there, while it was consistent with Hebrew understandings of the world, was not consistent with our understanding. And so we are at liberty, as with many other things, to say that was their understanding then. It is not our understanding today. Mm-hmm. Others?
I'll just ask you to be a fortune teller. There's this split in especially the Iowa Methodist Church. There's all these congregations leaving because of the gay issue.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think those churches that are leaving will slowly die off as generational change happens, or do you think they'll attract the haters out there?
What's going on in the United Methodist Church is a process of disaffiliation, and it's coming to a close here at the end of this year. On December the 31st, the paragraph in the discipline that allows for churches to leave the denomination through a process of discernment and paying of 2 years worth of apportionments, which is kind of like taxes to the denomination, plus support for the retired clergy that is still required going out and into the future. Once that process is finished, it will be much more difficult for churches to get out. The Iowa Conference has seen two sets of disaffiliations, 84 occurred in May, left in May, and another 59 left at a vote in November. And that'll be it for full-fledged disaffiliations of congregations. Most of those churches are small. Across the denomination, that's about 7,200 churches out of 30,000 churches will have disaffiliated out of the United Methodist Church when it's all said and done. Okay. What's going to happen to those churches that are disaffiliating? If I were to pull out a crystal ball, I'd say the vast majority of them, within 10 years, their membership will be over the age of 100. So yeah, a large number of them are going to die out. Others, there are some large congregations with full ranges of membership, children, youth, adults, senior adults, and they'll continue. But as the society continues to grow in understanding and acceptance and affirmation, we will see them become more and more and more marginalized. Yes, they'll attract haters to their membership, which will keep them alive and keep them going in many cases. But in truth, they will continue to be marginalized, especially amongst the young people today. And I believe that they will eventually shrink and shrink and shrink. And while there'll probably be some of them left, 30 and 40 years from now, I don't think they're going to survive. Any community that is built upon hate and exclusion cannot long-term survive in our society. It simply doesn't happen. More questions?
Yes, I was wondering what you think of Pope Francis. Pope Francis, the Catholic.
Pope Francis. Wow. Talk about an amazing man, especially after his predecessor, Pope Benedict. Pope Francis is a man with a huge, compassionate heart. And he is hampered by an institutional structure, the magisterium of the Roman Catholic Church, that means that changes can only happen in very tiny steps. We think the United Methodist Church has taken a long time when it's taken 50 years since 1972 to today to start to change those rules that were entered in 1972. The Roman Catholic Church has almost 2,000 years of history behind it, and it takes a long time to make changes. The last major set of changes was Vatican II back in the 1970s. The changes that occurred from that are still being fought against today in the Roman Catholic Church. I pray for Pope Francis, and I pray that some of the change in attitudes that he brings will continue with the next pontiff. And I hope and pray that they will continue to grow and change as they have moving into the future. I have the same prayer for the United Methodist Church. General Conference happens next year, late April, early May of 2024. It's taking place in Charlotte, North Carolina. And with all of the disaffiliating churches and leaders who will not be going to the next General Conference, who went to the last one in 2019, when the regulations were made much harsher and much more cruel against LGBTQ people and their allies. Many of them can't go because they're no longer United Methodist. They've lost their credentials. They've lost their standing in the denomination. They cannot go and they cannot vote. And they've been replaced by more progressive and centrist people who want to see change, who want to see the discipline changed. And it looks as though in General Conference next year, the United Methodist Church will be removing from its discipline the regulations against same-sex marriage, the regulations against the ordination of self-avowed practicing homosexuals, and a horrible statement that's in the discipline which says that the practice of homosexuality is incompatible with Christian teaching. All of that should be removed next year. by the General Conference. Unlike any time before in our past, the actual numerical count of the delegates indicates that they will have more than 50% of the vote to make that change. So instead of just wishful thinking and being hopeful that we can convince a few people to vote a different direction, and when I say a few, in 2019, the difference was about 25 people out of 800 delegates. Rather than hoping to be able to do it, we actually have the numbers. Always happy to answer any questions or to sit and chat with you. If you ever want to come see me, you can. Very, very happy to talk about anything and to help in our community. Thank you for having me today.